Good evening, everyone. My name is Charles, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Charles.
My clean date is November 9th, 1993. My home group is at You're Not Alone meeting that meets at St. Mary's Church every Saturday night at 8:30. And I do have a sponsor and a service commitment. And most importantly, I do have this fellowship. I buy into the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, and I think I owe a great deal of the life that I have today, the freedom that I have today, the choices that I make today, based on the idea of the friends and the associates that I make through this fellowship. And I'm thankful for Yvette for asking me to speak and share my experience and hope, and I'm always willing to do that because that's the only way I can get some clarity and some sense out of the otherwise life that I lived before I come into Narcotics Anonymous. I'm one of 12 children. I come from an abusive household. Father was a raging alcoholic. Mother was very codependent. And I'm not saying that that's what made me think and do the things that I did, but I'm sure it had a lot to do with it. I didn't know a lot about recovery. I didn't know a lot about life until I came into this fellowship. And I like to say today that I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I didn't know a lot. I'm grateful that I did have my addiction, because if it wasn't for my addiction, then I wouldn't have met the fellows in Narcotics Anonymous, and I wouldn't have met the 12-step program that guides my life today. Being one of 12 children, I come from an impoverished background in Asbury Park, New Jersey, in a little small one-horse town, and there wasn't a lot of room for black and white bathrooms and going to school on different buses and all that kind of stuff. It was a small minority town. It was a migrant town, and its main attraction was the boardwalk, set up for amusement for tourists. I didn't understand the value of that as a kid. All I knew is I woke up every morning and I smelled the scent of the ocean, and I loved it. There's another scent of the ocean that sticks with me, I went to school on the short bus, and I was considered a retard up until I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and I was considered a retard because I had an vision impairment, and that guided my life up to that point. Up to a young child, I was set aside as if I was retarded, as if I was slow. And by all means, by all recognition, if you saw me and observed me and talked to me, you would have found that I was a little slow. My nickname at that time was Grandpa. They called me Grandpa they called me Grandpa long after the problem was corrected. But I talk very slow, and I move even slower. And I recognize that today because I had an vision impairment, I couldn't hang with the rest of the kids. I tried to, but when we ran and played, and they ran through the yard, they would make it through the yard successfully. I get hung up on the clothesline, tripped over the tree stump, slapped in the face with the branch. So it didn't take me long as a kid to figure out that I can't hang. I couldn't hang with the regular kids. I couldn't hang with my brothers and sisters. I couldn't even hang with my little brother. Because there was something wrong with my life. I didn't have any idea of what it was. I sat in school, and this is how I ended up on the short bus. I sat in school and I daydreamed all day because I could not see the blackboard. So reading, writing, and arithmetic was far out of my reach. The teachers just put me on the pay me no mind list and let me sit there and daydream and look out the window. I was probably more attracted to the light than I was anything else. Me and Mike was on the way down, and we was listening to some jazz on the way down. And one of the outgrowths of that lifestyle, that condition, was that when I watched television at home with the rest of the family, and as a kid we watched a lot of cartoons, and you know, for some of you that don't remember, cartoons of old used to be to the background of jazz music and classical music. So I grew up with a great love for jazz and classical music. And it was strange because as the music would reach its crescendo, and everybody would laugh. And I would laugh when they say, da-da-da-da-da-da! And I'd say, and I was turned on by the music, but they were turned on by the Roadrunner getting clobbered in the head. But I never got to see that. So I got to love jazz. But they talk about being spiritually bankrupt. They talk about suffering from a spiritual void. And that's one of the aspects of my disease. And I think that's when that was nailed down for me. Because I became very self-centered. Not that I didn't have the right guidance, not that my folks didn't prompt me to go to church. It's my father. My father, when he quit drinking, he made us, beat us into the church. So it wasn't that I didn't have right guidance and right upbringing. It's just that my mind was already set. I was already self-centered. I was already thinking about nothing but myself. I had withdrawn into a world within my own mind. And I come to learn that's where my addiction lies. My addiction lies in my thinking. It's part of my mental state. And I never came to terms with that until I was beaten into a reasonable state of submission. And I had been beaten into a reasonable state of submission many times before I came to some conclusions about the way I thought and the way I behaved. But as a kid, and the smell of the ocean, I went in for a physical examination and it included an eye exam, and lo and behold, this boy can't see. So they sent a note to my parents to get the glasses, correct the vision problem. Well, they never did. They never would. And one nurse spotted the problem, spotted the dilemma, and expelled me from school until the problem was corrected. And my relationship with the ocean was one of sound and one of scent. And when my father begrudgingly took me to New York and got the glasses, one of the places that I always retreated to was the beach. And it was like, I come out of my door, make a right, and go 13 blocks. And I got my feet in the water. I'm in the ocean. So I did a lot of meditating. I did a lot of hanging out. I did a lot of isolating. For more better terms, I isolated a lot because I didn't play well with others. I hung with myself. But what happened was when I got the glasses, I ran to the beach because now I'm seeing things. I'm seeing things. I can see. I can see trees. I can see birds. I can see squirrels. I mean, I could see things that I could never see before. And one of the things that I wanted to see was the ocean. And I went to the ocean and playing around. Other kids out there. I took the glasses off. And of course, when I took the glasses off, I couldn't find them. And I went home without the glasses. And I got the worst ass whooping I ever got in my life. And I don't know how that ass whooping and the smell of the ocean still affects me today. But last Wednesday, or October 4th, whatever day it was, I turned 61 years old. And the smell of the ocean still remind me of a good ass whooping. So I have some thoughts and ideas in my head that started long before I came into the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. And they stayed with me. And they grew. One thing I came to terms with is the idea that addiction is fatal and progressive. You know, it never gets better. It always gets worse. 9 years old, coming from an abusive family, there was a lot of neglect. There was, my mother, like I said, was very codependent. So with 12 children or 10 of us, 9 of us hanging around the house at one time, there was not a whole lot of hands-on love. I mean, most of the attention was focused on my father, who was a serious drinker, gambler, womanizer, liar and a cheat. But he was my dad. And around 8, 9, after the glasses, and I hated him so much, I swore I will never, when I grow up, I'll never be like my father. I'll never be like my father. And unfortunately, the apple don't fall far from the tree. I could never wrestle any kind of love or affection from my mother. And one day my sister came home with a Coca-Cola bottle full of rum. And as a disposal, she said, "Come here, drink this." I had sipped my father's wine and gin, and he didn't drink too much beer, but I remember the gin a lot, because I remember that warm, cuddly feeling that I used to get. But I never really got a good buzz going. Well, they gave me that bottle of Coca-Cola at 9 years old, the bottle of rum, and I drank it, and I passed out. I suffered my first blackout. But I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning to my mother. Everybody else in the house was asleep. She was waiting for me. She got me out of bed. She held me to her bosom. She towel dried me because I had been sweaty and stinking and all that kind of stuff. And some insane thought clicked in my head that the way to get my mother's attention was to get drunk like my father. And at 9 years old, by the time I was 13, I was juggling weed, drinking booze, hustling nickels and dimes on the corner. I had already found the clique. Boys a lot older than me. I'm sneaking in the back of the pool halls. They want to shoot pool. They want to hang out on the corner. They want to play with the girls. I just want to get high. At 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, all I want to do is get bit. And that's what I proceeded to do. And at 13, every aspect of my life was geared around school. I quit school at 16. The school, my schoolmates, everything and everybody that I was about getting intoxicated, getting high. And I didn't understand that at all. I left home. As the progression of our family always went, and I moved to Trenton, New Jersey. School came up, and everybody went to school, and I was, again, isolated on the corner by myself. All my little schoolmates and playmates all going back to school, and I'm 17 years old next month, and I'm hanging on the corner by myself. Actually, I started going to the strawberry farm or something. One of them farms, my sister used to make me go to the farm. I think that's what prompted me to go into the service more than anything. The idea that she would get me up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go pick strawberries. I was walking downtown Trenton, New Jersey, and I saw Uncle Sam said, the sign says, "I want you." Now, you know, I had come up like a retard. They thought I was a retard, but I wasn't really a retard. When I got the vision problem corrected, I ain't gonna say I was genius, but I was close to it. I could pass a test. And I went up and took the induction test for the military, and they said, "Oh, great, whatever you want to be, whatever you want to do, pick it, choose it." Now, this is 1963, and the draft is going on. And Vietnam is just a slight whisper. The French was involved in it. But I'm thinking that I'm going to get the induction period. You know, I'll sign up now in October, and I'll go in April. You know, I've already had it figured out. 7 months, 6 months. I went and took the test the next morning. They gave me a bus ticket, everything. Go down to Newark, New Jersey, induction center, and they marched me through the process, and here I stood saying I do. and I'm marching out the door onto the bus. And I'm still a mama's boy. I'm still afraid of people. I'm being marched on a bus and told to shut up. You're in the army now. You're on the bus. But I ain't supposed to be going. I'm supposed to come back in April. I ain't even got on the clean pair of drawers. I need to talk to my mama. Shut up and get on the bus. I got on the bus. I can't tell my story without talking about racism. Because in 1919, I got a culture shock in 1964. I ran into racism. Coming up in a one-horse town, I didn't have time. I ran with the little white kids, the little Puerto Rican kids. We all hung together. There was no room for that kind of stuff. Because if I was mad at you, then I just ain't had nobody to hang out with. So there wasn't a whole lot of room for prejudice and that kind of stuff. But when I went to Richmond, Virginia, Petersburg, Virginia, I ran into the black water fountain. For a lot of you who haven't seen it, the white water fountain, the white bathroom for whites only, for blacks only. I ran into that at 17 years old. It was a culture shock for me. And I experienced the anger that I had never experienced before. And just like every other pain, I always dealt with it with more booze and more dope. More booze, more dope. The greater the pain, the more dope I use. The more I use to medicate and get rid of the pain. And 17, I went to my first detox. I was somebody spotted a potential drug addict, alcoholic coming up in the works. Here he come. They sent me to detox. Say, if you don't straighten up, we're going to discharge you from the military. They did discharge me. It was 3 years, 3 years and some months later, because I ended up staying over my 3 years, because I ended up going to jail a couple of times while there. I tried to volunteer to go to Vietnam. They laughed at me. They said they wasn't going to give me no live ammo. But I didn't want to go to Vietnam for the war. I wanted to go to Vietnam because everybody from Vietnam was coming for RR over in Europe, and they was coming with China White Thai sticks. I mean, I ain't never seen no stuff like this, man. Sign me up. Screw the fact that they dying over there. I want some of that China White. And you know, and that kind of thinking, followed me all through my life. And I found myself, and I'm gonna cut to the chase. I found myself November 9th, 1993, in that same dilemma that I was in 1963. They sent me to detox. They told me you had a problem. Boy, you got a problem. It took me 40 years. Of in and out, up and down, over and under, fail and success. 40 years before I could finally say, ouch, that really hurts. Ouch, 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 this shit ain't working no more. And that's what happened. Now, I finally come across a problem. The pain got bad enough to where the drugs wouldn't fix it anymore. I couldn't get rid of the pain. I couldn't, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get away from the pain. And using was the only thing I knew. And I worked for an airline manufacturer. We built airplanes. Great job. My criminal background, and I had a huge one, extensive, very extensive. They gave me a confidential clearance. They sent me to New York on a training program. It's a shame. It's a shame. I can't tell you, but it's just a shame. You guys can imagine. They sent me from Stuart, Florida to New York. I'm from Jersey. It was a crew of us. That was a shame, because we looked like the Keystone Cops running around New York. We knew every little cop hole. in Manhattan before we left there. And I don't know how I learned anything on the job, period. But I see some of my coworkers now. We don't work together, but I see them occasionally. And all we can do is laugh at each other. We look at each other and laugh at the annex that we performed during those 13 weeks we spent in New York. It was a joke. Anyway. And that was typical of my life. I had intelligence, and that wasn't the problem. I was smart enough to do almost anything I wanted to do. But what I always ended up doing was getting high. And because I wanted to get high so much, there was no stick-to-itiveness. There was no sustaining. I couldn't keep nothing. No great relationship, couldn't keep it. Great job, couldn't keep it. Great house on the corner of the county line. Two cars, a car, and both garages. Swimming pool, too. Police kicked that door down. Boom! The house still there. It breaks my heart every time I go by there to think about where I go and where I fall from. Where I go and where I fall from. Where I go, what I can get, what I can muster in my life, what I can get with all this energy and all this intelligence that I got, what I can build up for my life, only to destroy it again. And nobody put a gun in my head to make me destroy it. I made stupid decisions. I made rational decisions. I made sacrifices. I mean, I call it sacrifice, but that I'm not even going to dignify it and call it a sacrifice, because I have a whole different concept and idea of what a sacrifice is. If you want to grow spiritually, that's when you sacrifice. If you want to just be stupid, that's when you let stuff go. I let a lot of stuff go. I didn't sacrifice it. I let a lot of stuff go. I made stupid choices, and the choices cost me dearly. But you know what? I pay it all again to get to where I am today. Because I have a life today far beyond my wildest imagination. I have a captive audience right now. You might not all be captive, but a few of you here are captive because you can relate to what I'm talking about. 1993, same pickle jar. I'm the same cucumber that was dropped in that pickle jar in 19, when they plucked me out the pickle jar. I was still a pickle. That means I was an addict then, and I'm an addict now. I'm still an addict, but I'm an addict in recovery. I'm an addict that's living the principled life today. I'm an addict that's giving back what's been freely given to him. I'm an addict that practiced the application of traditions and spiritual principles in his life today. That's why I'm here, to make that otherwise senseless, worthwhile life something worthwhile. November 9th, 1993, I'm blind. 9:30 on a Monday morning. Jobs got in the way. I used to make submarine engines for De La Valle Turbine Corporation, too. I could never go back to that job. They don't even want me nowhere on the property. I think they got a picture in the guard shack. I'm going back 35 years. You know, they got a picture in the guard shack with skull and crossbones. Shoot to kill. I can never go back to that job. November 9th, I'm on a street corner. Now, I'm on the corner because I had just come out of the bushes. It's funny. It is funny. Because I'm in the bushes because I got kicked out of a rooming house. A rooming house, a year earlier, I wouldn't even have been caught dead in. I wouldn't even have been caught. The kind of people that lived in that room house, they kicked me out. I became an undesirable. They kicked me out the room and house. And for lack of anywhere else to go, because I was so caught up in this obsession of the mind and these streams of thought about using, my whole life was dependent on the phone, the payphone on the corner of that room and house. So like all the other migrants, I migrated across the street to the bushes. And I had somebody watch the phone for me. Because I had a little intelligence, but I had more gusto And I'm not going to call it, dignify it and call it bravado. I was driven by an obsession of the mind. That's what it was. It wasn't no courage that made me set this network up where I can boom, 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 boom. I was driven by an obsession of the mind that kept my hook up tight. You, and you. You do this, you do this, and you do that. And they listened to me. And we all got paid. And life was good. Except when somebody said, "Charlie, here they come." And you think they were talking about the police. I break around the corner and I peek through the bushes and here comes this woman with two little kids. I ain't got no time for no kids. I ain't got no time for no love. They want me to come home and take a bath. I ain't got no time for no bath, and my white truck gonna be here in a minute. They better get on out of here. They gone yet. In the meantime, there's somebody behind the other tree want to bust me in the head. Wait for me to throw my stash down so they can run off with my stash. And I couldn't understand that kind of psychic thinking. I'm running away from people that want to love me and running to people that want to beat me and rock me. And I'm okay with that. I'm good. Life's good. And that's the insanity of my thinking, because I couldn't see past my obsession. I couldn't see past my network of things that were instrumental in me getting my libation, me fulfilling my self-centered ideas and my self-centered thoughts. I couldn't see past that. So 9:30 that morning, I come out of the bushes, and because I didn't want people to see me in the bushes, I stood in front of this house across the street. Roman house on this corner, the bushes on this corner, the woman's house on this corner. So I can't go to the Roman house, so I got to stand across the street on the other house, in front of the woman's house. And she called the police on us. And I got indignant. But there was an incident that I shared for 7 years that took place. And there was another incident, the underlying incident that it took me 7 years to address. And if I can explain this, let me share this with you. Because the police came and they arrested me, and I'll skip all of that, looking at the badge and talking stupid to the police. Don't even realize I'm talking to the police. But I went to jail. They took my happy ass to jail. And I thought this was my first contact with powerlessness, because I got a pocket full of dope, I got a pocket full of money, I got more dope coming, I got the deal, I got a thing going, and the last thing I want to do now is have this interrupted. The last thing I want to do when the coke man finishes with the reefer man, I'm gonna have some reefer and coke. I already got reefer and coke. I'm just the shit. And I got people pulling on me and yanking on me. Charlie, you the man, Charlie, you the man. The last thing I want to do is go to jail. But I remember the police said, "Look, if you gotta go, you gotta go." And that was powerlessness. That's what I understood to be powerlessness. But that wasn't it. Because it wasn't my first time being locked up. Actually, I wasn't arrested. I was rescued. But I got up the next day out of jail, and I made a collect call to my 14-year-old. And all I wanted was a kind word. That's all I wanted her, to share a little love with Dad. You know, and I know I've been negligent, and I know, but she loved me. She loved me unconditionally. She loved me so much, she had a grandmama coming all down on the corner looking for me, searching for me. And I would see her looking for me, and I would run. And I was an embarrassment to her and her friends. She would ask me to leave when her friends came. I called her. And she began to read me the riot act. She began to tell me how irresponsible I was. How not only are you a piss poor excuse for a father, you're a piss poor excuse for a human being. And she asked me, when are you ever going to grow up? Now, this is a 14-year-old talking to a 47-year-old. When are you ever going to grow up? Now, honey, come on, please. But she kept on. And in the moment of clarity, and I consider this a miracle in my recovery program, in a moment of clarity, the light went on. And I realized that this girl is trying to save my life. Just like a parent would be trying to save a child's life. Trying to admonish me and steer me in the right direction. My 14-year-old. And the reality of the truth of that situation hurt me. I can't describe how that reality hurt me. That I was failing. Not only as a father, but as a human being. And I said a prayer that day that I was arrested the day before. And I, God, please don't let them take me to jail now. Please don't let them take me to jail. They took me to jail anyway. But the next day, after I got off that phone, I went back and I said another prayer to the God of my misunderstanding. And I said, God, please help me be a better father. Help me be a better father. And don't let me ever disappoint this child like this again. And then I set into place this little manipulation of working the system to try to maneuver my way out of jail. And I got a felony for possession of cocaine and possession of paraphernalia. But the worst charge that I got out of those charges that I was arrested for that day was creating a public nuisance. I had my life, that ain't funny. My life had been resolved to the point where I was a freaking nuisance. And that disturbed me more than the the felony possession of cocaine. Now, you know, because my daughter just read me the Riot Act, and I'm saying, damn, I'm just going to hell in a handbasket. But I'm trying to work the system, and I'm trying to get into the drug program so that I can beat the felony possession of cocaine 10 weeks in, 10 weeks out, and I'm out of here. And I ain't thinking about getting clean. I ain't thinking about changing my life. I ain't thinking about having a spiritual awakening. I ain't thinking about sharing with another addict. I ain't thinking about none of that. The experience of the hope, all I want to do is get out of here. But I had a plan, and God had a plan. And I'm glad today that God's plan is the plan that worked in my life. Oh, I got my cheerleader button on. I changed shirts. I found this button has been staring me in the face because it's been on my nightstand, I guess, for years. And I put it on my shirt tonight. What the hell did I do with it? It stuck me. I had it in my pocket. But it says, I am a cheerleader dad. And it had dollar signs all around it. I think that was typical, too. Because a year into recovery, that same child invited me back into her life to be a cheerleader booster parent. But let me tell you how the program works with the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. I'm in the program. I'm in the program trying to beat the system. But I heard somebody share my story. Somebody told my story. And I wanted what he had. I especially wanted to walk out the door when this meeting was over. That's what I really wanted. I really wanted to just walk out the door. When it's over, say, amen, keep coming back, and bing, I'm out of here. That's what I really wanted. But he said, if you want what I got, you do what I do. And I began to investigate and find out what it was he did. And he followed the suggestions of this program. Read the basic text, get a home group, get a sponsor, get involved in service. And I did that. And because I did that, the life that I live today is a more principled life. The freedom that I have today is far beyond any freedom that I have ever known. And if you want to know freedom, then come out of the bondage. Come out of the bondage of addiction. Come out of it. Because there is no greater prison, there is no greater incarceration than the incarceration of a closed mind. And that's where I was. I was set on that fixed idea that I'm just another addict, always was and always will be. This is the life that's dedicated and designed for me. But I met this dilemma. And I told you that I thought it was this idea that I wanted to be a better father, and that did set the course. But 7 years into recovery, a whole lot of stuff was going on. I was dating a girl that was smoking pot. But see, God does for me what I can't do for myself. And what happened when I started dating the female that was smoking the pot was I cut myself. I started to isolate myself from the fellowship. I started to isolate myself from the people that had come to know me, and I had come to know them, and they had known my life, and they had become a part of my life. Now all of a sudden I'm cutting them out of my life. And I'm sitting up, and she was giving me ultimatums. If you're, well, I'm going over here and play dominoes. You can go over there. You can go be with them folks if you want to. Ah, screw them folks. They ain't doing nothing but lying anyway. I'm going to see he going to mock me, say the same old thing he say every week. Stan, I already know what Stan going to say. And, Mike going to have a burning desire. And I had started setting myself up. And then I found myself sitting around the card table. And deja vu overtook me. And I remember not being a part of, but being a part from. Neither this nor that. And I'm just here. And I don't want to be here. Just like that morning that I was arrested. When the police rolled up, nobody said, Bible. 99. Watch your back, Charlie. Jigs up. Nobody said nothing. They just let the police roll up on me. And it dawned on me that, you know, nobody said 5-0. I didn't hear nobody say jig up. Nothing. But it took me 7 years to come to terms with the isolation and loneliness that surrounded me in my active addiction. Lonely, isolated. Talk about a spiritual bankruptcy. I mean, I'm so caught up in my own little world. Not even other addicts want to have a part of me. And I think they hanging out. They my buzz. They my type was my dog. As long as I got dope, because I was networking. I was working. I was hustling my ass off. But just like my mother, I had some codependent issues. I had to have them people around me. I had to network. If I didn't network, then I would be alone. But guess what? I was networking. I had people around me, but I was still alone. And that was the greatest prison, and that was the greatest incarceration that I had ever known. That loneliness, that isolation that comes when you are cut off and apart from everything else, including reality. I was cut off from reality. I mean, there was no up or down or in or out. I was just fucked up. That's all I was. Stoned. That's all I was. That's all I stayed. That's where I wanted to be. Why that intolerable existence? I don't know. I think it was all to get me where I am today. It was all to get me to understand and appreciate the freedom and the love that I have today. Because I got a lot of love. And I got a lot of freedom. And I got a lot of choices. And I can do a lot of things. And I can go a lot of places. And I can be a lot of things that I could never, ever have been had I not been introduced to this program and the principles that guide my life today. The principle of hope. The principle of courage. The principle of honesty. Especially the principle of humility. And I might talk a lot of junk, but inside me there's still a scared boy that wants you to love me. But if you don't love me, then I know that God loves me. And if I trust the love of God, then the love of God will allow me to love you. And if I love you, guess what? Y'all gonna love me back. I trust that process. I trust that idea. I didn't have no idea that in order to understand and appreciate love, you had to love. Duh. I think if I break you off, if I take care of that for you, hey, look, come on, me and you, I got it. You know, if I just spread the table around, you would love me. Bullshit. I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I found love right here. And when I found love right here, I found love right there. And that's how this program works for me. Because instead of being selfish and self-centered, now I'm spiritually principled. That's what I bring to the table today. I bring some hope to the table today. I bring some courage to the table today. That you, if you suffer from that same isolation and loneliness, if you suffer from that same obsessive thought and stream of thoughts that guide your life, you don't never have to suffer from it again. There is a cure for that. It's called Narcotics Anonymous in the 12 steps. It's called the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, where the therapeutic value of one addict sharing with another is invaluable. You'll find place. You'll find validation. You'll find credit, self-worth, right here. And that's how it happened for me. I didn't talk to my daughter today, and I usually talk to her every day. And Mike, we're gonna call after I leave here, because she called me last night with an earache. 28 years old, and she still called me with, "Daddy, I got an earache." But I'm thankful for that, because when she was a kid having earaches, I was never there. I'm thankful for grandkids. She has an 8-year-old. I'm thankful that God has a sense of humor, because while I missed her 8-year-old, I get to share with my granddaughter's 8-year-old. So I live vicariously through my granddaughter and my daughter. She gets to see me love her daughter. And she loves that to death, because she's always pushing her on me. Call your papa! And that's good that I can be here today. Because I wasn't here before. I wasn't here for her. I wasn't here for my son. But I could be present and accountable. And I can bring something to the table today. And because of this fellowship and this program, you know, the life I have is far beyond my wildest imagination. And if you keep doing what I do, you'll get what I get. I can't describe what I got, but I know to sum it up, it's a lot of love for you guys and girls. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.